on The Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
We're delighted to welcome back to On The Bookshelf J. Warner Wallace, America's foremost cold case detective. His newest book, Person of Interest, Why Jesus Still Matters in a World That Rejects the Bible. It's from Zondervan Reflective Press. Warner Wallace was a cold case detective, which means he took on the cases that had existed for some time and had never been solved. Uses his skills to do the same thing with proving the historicity of Jesus Christ without relying on the New Testament.
Says, you know, you work a bunch of these different kinds of cases simultaneously. And I had a number of cases that I was in the middle of when my sergeant came and said, hey, can you kind of push this across the goal line and solve this case? Because it was something he had been personally involved in both early on in his career, and it had been cold for a number of years. Murders have no statute of limitations, right. So you can go back and work these years later. And that's exactly what happened here. And so he was interested in solving it, more interested, to be honest, than I was in adding it to my caseload. But some of these are more difficult than others. And this was a case in which there was no body because it was taken as a missing persons. And the husband had killed his wife, reported that she ran off, said that, she hadn't come back. And the first officers believed that, took it as a missing persons case. And then years go by, and she never shows up. She had small children, sometimes this one didn't, but I've had a couple now where they've had small children and they've never contacted their family, right? Mm. Well, this particular case, she was a very young woman who really gave no sign of being interested in traveling, why'd she disappear? So it ends up being an unsolved missing persons. Well, what you do in those kinds of cases where you don't have any evidence from a crime scene, there is no crime scene that was even photographed, no body has ever been discovered. Well, what you do is you tell the jury, okay, I'm going to make this case in front of a jury by examining the fuse that burned up to that moment in which something explosive probably happened if, in fact, he killed her. And then all that shrapnel from that bomb that's exploded and is all over the crime scene. We're going to make the case in front of the jury from the fuse and the fallout, even though we have nothing from the actual crime scene. So why that's important as a methodology is that I was somebody who did not accept as trustworthy anything in the New Testament. So if you could actually make the case, though, for Jesus of Nazareth by simply studying the fuse of history and the fallout of history, even if every single New Testament had been destroyed, so there's no body and there's no crime in a crime scene, no evidence of the crime scene, you could still make the case for Jesus just from the artifacts of history. And you can actually reconstruct the story of Jesus so you understand who he is in his entirety, even if you destroyed every single new... That's the kind of impact that Jesus of Nazareth had on history. And so with this book, what we're just basically doing is studying the fuse and the fallout. So I've written a book called Cold Case Christianity where we're examining the Gospels, we're examining right. The New Testament. But imagine just the opposite approach. Forget about the New Testament. You could examine everything outside of the New Testament and come to the same conclusion. And that's what we're doing in this book.
I find this such a refreshing way of looking at proving the historicity of Jesus. The idea of the fuse, which would be in this particular case, all of the prophecies in the Old Testament, but also the types of Christ that we find in the Old Testament, heroes that have many traits in common with what a Messiah was supposed to be, and yet they were not the Messiah. So we put together this evidence of what are we expecting Messiah to be like, and that was the beginning of working on the fuse, right?
Yeah, well, for me, because I didn't trust anything in the Old Testament either, I wanted to look at aspects of culture that really had nothing to do with Christianity or Judaism. So if you just looked at the history of the spiritual, all the ancients who worshipped one god or another, and you trace that development of their mythologies, if you look at just the history of empires, leading up to and including the Roman Empire, and then you also look at the prophecies that are from the Old Testament, so you can include those. But all three of those strands of the fuse actually provide a small window of opportunity, and I just demonstrate this in one chapter of the book, where there's actually a window of about 29 B.C. to about 70 A.D., in which it's clear there's a small window here in which something amazing can happen. And it just so happens to coincide with the calendar break, right, the first century calendar break in which the Common Era is inaugurated. And it also happens to coincide with the appearance of Jesus of Nazareth. And so when you see that little red zone of opportunity is so narrow, and Jesus happens to be standing right in the middle of it, I think it is eye-opening, and it actually kind of explains that verse from Scripture where Paul talks about Jesus arriving in the fullness of time. And you'll see that he actually does arrive in the fullness of time, not just in terms of the Jewish predictions for his arrival, but also in the way that culture, empires, even people who expect God to arrive at some point, who have imagined God in their own mind in any number of ways, like Paul talks about in Acts 17, all of these things align in such a way historically that there's this window of opportunity in which Jesus can arrive and not only have the kind of impact that he had, but give feet to the people like Paul, who traveled on Roman roads that were not even available 2 centuries earlier, but were now available for him to preach the message of Jesus. So it's just a fascinating way to look at the history leading up to Jesus.
Well, I've always loved history, and when I first heard that phrase, in the fullness of time, I thought, well, okay, so what is it exactly does that mean? All the elements, all of these things had to be in place. And when you look at, there had not been a system of roads prior to the time that Jesus was born and lived here on earth, and that gave the access to Paul and all of the others to travel to many places to spread the news. If Jesus had been born, as you point out, 100 years earlier, that wouldn't have happened. There wouldn't have been nearly as many people who could have learned about it. And you also point out about the alphabet, how critical it was the development of a relatively simple and universal alphabet, which most people don't think about. They just assume automatically, well, you know, there's been writing for a long time, so what difference does that make? But you point out in your book that the alphabet was being developed for centuries, but it was at a particular point that it was the most useful at the time that Christ was on earth.
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at the earliest kind of pictographs and cuneiforms, and even those early alphabets that don't have as many vowels as we have now in the Etruscan alphabet, and that Etruscan alphabet emerges on the Italian peninsula and becomes the adopted alphabet of the Romans who conquer the known world and bring with it a form of conversational Greek, which they picked up from the Greeks. And so you have language, verbal language, and written language available on papyrus rather than on clay tablets or on stone that can travel. And then you have a period of peace because they were dominating the entire landscape. In that period of peace called the Pax Romana, they can now shift resources away from wars toward the buildings of roads and bridges and tunnels. That expression that all roads lead to Rome is there for a reason, because at one time, you know, there definitely were roads. The Persians were also good road builders, but they didn't have the expansive connection to all the known parts of the world that the Romans did. Even the Silk Road coming over from China was made available. So now everything is connected in a way, at a moment in history in which Daniel predicts that something is going to happen with the coming Messiah, right? It should be here by the destruction of the temple, which we know occurs in 70. So you've got a small window in which something can occur and meet all of these preconditions and expectations, and sure enough, Jesus arrives just at that moment, and the message of Jesus explodes across the empire.
Now, another strand that you chased down as part of the fuse was the idea that the type of theology that was being practiced in and around the Mediterranean basin and in the Middle East was developing in such a way that it was more and more likely that people would be open to the idea of a creator and a redeemer and sustainer. The stage is being set theologically for the acceptance of someone like Jesus, who came along and said, "I'm God in the flesh." Right.
Well, how many times have you heard that you know, Jesus is just another fiction in a long line of fictions of rising, dying and rising saviors, you know, he's a copycat savior. This has been very popular in the last couple of decades, this idea that, oh yeah, I see some similarities between Jesus and other mythologies. He's just considered to be then another mythology. But the reality of it is, if you examine the mythologies prior to Jesus, the ancient gods worshipped by ancient people groups, what you'll see is, yeah, I actually identify in the book 15 attributes of mythologies that seem to resemble each other. So if you were just look at all the mythologies, forget about Jesus for a minute, you would see these 15 common expectations of the ancients that then are reiterated in their mythologies. Now, not many mythologies possess more, I can't find really any of them that possess more than about 10 of these common expectations, and some as few as 6. But if you look at the ancient mythologies, you will see that somewhere between 6 and 10 of these attributes are present. And then comes Jesus of Nazareth at a time when the most people groups are still worshiping their myths. And he meets not only between six, he is the only one who has all 15 attributes. So if God was intending to come at a time when Paul could say on Mars Hill in Acts 17, "You people are very religious, but let me tell you, of the one true God, who we know is a true God because we saw him alive after the crucifixion. We saw him resurrected to demonstrate his deity. And when he speaks of Jesus, the people to whom he is speaking would see something and hear something. They would go, wow. He meets the expectations of the ancients in the number of, for example, one of these common expectations is just that, you know, God should be able to work miracles. God should appear miraculously. If there is a God, he should be able to live forever. These are things that you would commonly expect us to think about if we're thinking about God. Well, Jesus meets those expectations, even though he may surprise you in the way he meets them. And by the way, the similarities to the mythologies are so overstated. You know, if a God emerges out of the side of a mountain, you could say, well, is that the same as being born of a virgin? Certainly, he appears miraculously in an unusual, extra-natural way. But to say that somehow a copy for Jesus, you know, is copying that is ridiculous, right? They're not similar enough. But again, they both have meet the broad expectation that if there is a God, he would enter the world in a way that surprises you. That's the broad expectation. And that is very common in mythologies. But why would you think that would surprise you? I mean, if we're thinking about God, we would think certain characteristics, as Paul said, you're very religious people. You even have a monument to the unknown God. You're thinking about God. Well, let me tell you who the true God is. And so there's a window here, even in which Jesus can meet the expectations of the ancient worshipers.
We're talking to J. Warner Wallace, who is the author of Person of Interest, Why Jesus Still Matters in a World That Rejects the Bible. It's from Zondervan Publishing and is just being released. The difference between clear and cloaked evidence plays into what can we expect from the different types of evidence that we have that Jesus was who he claimed to be. And I found this very interesting, too.
Well, a lot of it is, you know, if you think about the prophecies that are typically listed that Jesus matches, a lot of Jewish believers would say, well, wait a minute, that prophecy is not even, that's not even about the Messiah. That's, the New Testament authors are taking those prophecies and they are twisting them to make them match Jesus. You know, well, in every crime scene, you have two kinds of evidence. You have clear evidence like fingerprints. If you've got a big fingerprint database, you can identify a suspect just from his fingerprint. Before you ever knock on his door, you already know who he is because this piece of evidence points to the suspect in advance of you meeting him. At the same time, there'll also be cloaked evidences in a crime scene, like a button, let's say, where, you know, you can't find a button missing from the victim's clothing, but maybe this button is from the suspect. But it could also be a button that was laying on the floor before the fight began.
Right.
So the question is, how do I know? Well, if you meet this suspect a year later or 2 weeks later, hopefully, and you examine his clothing and find that he's got a missing button on his shirt, well, now that button actually can identify and be used to identify your suspect, even though it didn't point to him in advance. It confirms him after the fact. Well, prophecy is also like that. There are some that are very clear, and there are some that are cloaked. And so when a New Testament author mentions a cloaked prophecy, like the button that happens to match Jesus' shirt, this prophecy happens to match everything about Jesus, that should be fair game for us to consider, because you would certainly not throw away the button as if it has no evidential value. You would say, no, even the cloaked evidence. But what I try to do in the book is separate those two so you can see what are the clear evidences from prophecy and what are the cloaked evidences from prophecy. And even if you say, okay, just for sake of argument, I'm not going to consider any cloaked evidence. I'm not even going to consider the cloaked evidence that a New Testament author would offer. Okay, fine, just for the sake of argument, if you want to do that. But I show in the book how even from just the clear prophecies, you are kind of stuck with the person of Jesus as the target of those prophecies.
The idea of fallout, that if Jesus is true, if he is really the Son of God, then the time that he was on earth and the claims of resurrection and the claims of this being the Son of God had to leave fallout. And that's what the second half of the book is really all about. Just like as in a murder investigation, there are ramifications of whatever occurred. And that's part of the evidence you look for. You use that same kind of concept in trying to figure out, okay, if Jesus was true, then he had to have an impact on history since the time he walked the earth.
Yeah, and I only focused on those areas where you could reconstruct the story of Jesus. So I'm looking for those areas in our culture in the last 2,000 years in which Jesus and his followers have had very deep impact. And then two, I'm looking for those areas of his deep impact where you could reconstruct the story of Jesus even if every New Testament had been destroyed. So I end up looking at six areas: art, visual arts, music, literature, education, science, believe it or not, and world religions. It turns out those six areas are so deeply indebted to Jesus of Nazareth that we would not be able to even experience them the way we have if not for Jesus and his followers. And from those areas, you can completely reconstruct the story of Jesus. I'll give you an example of this. In the sciences, if you look at the history of science and the progress of science, and you charted it, which I do in the book, and then you place Jesus in the timeline to see, like, you know, you'll see the eventual incline, and then finally by the 16th, 17th centuries, you've got the scientific revolution and an explosion, and every single modern discipline in the sciences is founded during those 200-year period of time, right?
Right.
Well, if you look at that explosion of growth in the scientific discovery and place Jesus in the timeline, you're going to discover that he stands just before the curve. He doesn't have to stand there. He could have stood 1,000 years before the curve even began, or he could have appeared 1,000 years after the growth of science. But it turns out he happens by coincidence, right? Or is it a catalyst? Which is it? Well, it turns out he inaugurates a worldview. I have a chapter where I talk about how he inaugurated this worldview that is a distinct igniter for the exploration of the sciences. And in fact, all of the fathers and founders of the modern disciplines of science, all of the major disciplines, and the list I have in the index is huge.
Yes.
If you look at them all the way from astronomy to chemistry to quantum mechanics, computer sciences, you will discover that the fathers and founders of those disciplines are all Christ followers. And they have written about Jesus in their personal journals. So if you didn't have the works of the church fathers in the first 300 years, but you had every journal of every science father, and by the way, we dominate the sciences throughout all of history. In fact, even more Nobel Prize winners in the sciences are Christian, 2-1 over any other group, and they're only, you know, about 6-1 over non-believers. And so the idea that you cannot be a Jesus follower and actually found a discipline in the sciences is just not historically true. We have always led in the sciences, and people will say, well, yeah, because, you know, in Europe, everyone was a Christian in the 16th and 17th century. Well, why? So why did science explode in Europe? That people group is much smaller than, say, going east into Asia. Why is it that Christendom in Europe happens to be the igniter for the sciences when there are so many other people groups that outnumber European Christians at that time? But this is where it's happening. Why? It's because there's something about the worldview, and so you can reconstruct the story of, actually, of all the areas I examined, you could reconstruct the story of Jesus most deeply, most robustly, from the science fathers, because these folks were all Jesus followers who saw no contradiction at all in their worldview between the miracles worked by Jesus and their study of the natural world. And this is all the way through into modern times. So I have a complete list. You can see all the kind of the tip of the iceberg scientists from every epic period of science history. And when you see the impact that Jesus has had in that area, look, as an atheist, the things that I became a Christian at 35. So, and I was not interested in Christianity prior to that. But I walked into a church and the pastor said this thing. He said this crazy thing. He said that Jesus was the smartest person who ever lived. And that was the very first thing I heard a pastor say about Jesus.
Hmm.
And I thought, is that true? And that's what started all this for me. And as I read through that, now look, the things that I would have said as an atheist were important to me, because I was an artist before I became a police officer. This is
right.
A weird combination, I know. But okay, so that's why there's so many drawings. We did 400 drawings for a book that has less than 300 pages. So the idea here is it's more kind of like a graphic novel, kind of like a murder mystery, kind of like an investigation about Jesus. But the idea for me as an atheist, I would have told you that what matters in life is the arts, music, education, science. These are things that I would have said, literature. These are things that would matter to me. Well, it turns out all those things that mattered to me as an atheist are so deeply indebted to Jesus and his followers, and I just didn't know the impact that Jesus has had in those five areas. Now, I would not have been interested in world religions. But it turns out that even world religions hat-tip Jesus unanimously.
Yes.
So even those religions that precede Jesus, as they emerge into the common era alongside Christianity, the leaders of those systems begin to acknowledge that Jesus fits in some way into Hinduism, into Krishna, into Buddhism. And so you'll see that the leaders in those groups will speak about Jesus in a favorable way and even give you enough data about Jesus that you could reconstruct the story of Jesus from the other world religions. You know, in Baha'i, for example, he's a manifestation. In Islam, he's a prophet. And, you know, in all these systems that follow Jesus, he's included. But even the systems that precede Jesus end up modifying themselves in some way after the appearance of Jesus to accommodate him.
Right.
So if you're going to start as a seeker, and you're interested in God and has God ever visited us, you'd be wise to start with Jesus, just because he's the one figure in history that is hat-tipped in every other system, even though Jesus says nothing about them. And never a kind, but I'm the only way to the Father. Except through me, no one gets to the Father. Yet every other system includes him in some way. And that sometimes is the case. Like when you have a suspect who's the real suspect, if I got five guys who I'm looking at for a murder, you know, the other four will be eliminated at some point because they have some things in common that are just not unique enough to be, they weren't available or didn't have this unique relationship, or there's something unique about the true suspect that separates him from the pack. And that's what we see in Christianity. There's something unique about Jesus that separates him from the pack. You know, it's the one system that does not require you to do anything. It's the one anomaly, the one system that says, no, it's what I did for you, not what you could do for me. And that's a very different approach to, and that's why I say if you're interested in God at all, you probably should start with Jesus, because he's the one character that appears everywhere else.
Basically, every other religion in the world offers you a way to achieve nirvana or heaven or paradise. They're all do-it-yourself religions. Christianity is the only one where God says, no, you can't do it. You can't earn it. You can't ever be good enough. So I'll have to come and rescue you.
Well, and that's why when you ask people who are in those other systems, do you think when you die you will reach whatever the highest goal of your system is, if that's heaven, if that's nirvana, if that's whatever, most will say, well, I hope so, because they don't know if their works have been sufficient for them to progress to the next stage, whereas the Christian can know now. I think it's in 1 John, it said you can know now that you are saved. And how could you know now unless this is not something you've earned? But you can know now because if you've accepted Christ as Lord, you know now that you are saved. That's a very different system, very different approach. And so that unique feature of Jesus as a character in history separates him from the other wise. Even if all you thought was, I don't believe in God, I don't believe in, but there are some ancients who have wisdom. Well, he is different than the other ancients who have wisdom. That's why even though he is preceded by Buddhism, preceded by Krishna, preceded by Zoroaster, preceded by Hinduism, he does not acknowledge those systems. He stands apart from those. That's just one of those things you can look at. Now, those six things, I think, are part of the fallout of history that not only show the deep impact that this figure in history, who has no right to have this kind of impact, he's a nobody family, he doesn't have no financial resources, born in a nowhere town, raised in another nowhere town, never travels more than 200 miles from either of those towns. He leads an army, never leads a nation, never writes a book, never writes a concert, a sonnet, a poem. He's got no stature globally. He's got no stature even locally. He's betrayed by the people who say they love him. He's hunted and persecuted by the people who say they're religious and moral. He is falsely accused, mocked, beaten, brutally executed, and has to borrow a grave. This is the guy who changes all of history and impacts the areas that most atheists find to be the most valuable anyway. I mean, think about all the people who are in the first century. I make a list in one of the chapters in the book. If you didn't know anything about why the Common Era starts in the first century, and you just looked at all of the historical characters that existed and lived in the first century, you would never pick Jesus of Nazareth, because there are just too many other people that led nations. Yet all of those people had no impact compared to Jesus. And that, to me, is just remarkable, unless, of course, he is who he said he was.
Yeah.
Now that begins to make sense, because if the God of the universe steps into his creation, wouldn't you expect the kind of impact that Jesus of Nazareth had? And that's what I think we're looking at.
Warner, I tell you, been privileged to interview you every time you came out with a new book. And each time, I'm always delighted and amazed at new ways of proving that Jesus is who he claims to be. And your latest book, Person of Interest, is the very best one yet. And just in how you show all of these different religious systems around the world and how they accommodated Christ after he had been here on earth, it says that there's something about this guy that's very different. And the only realistic thing to do, once you look at all the evidence, is say he is who he says he is. And therefore, we must worship him because he is worthy.
Well, I appreciate that you even have me on after we write these books, but that's the hope. The hope is, look, in the end, when you're working cold cases, it's not like you're like Sherlock Holmes. It's just that you start to look in places that other people haven't looked, because obviously if there was something to find there, they would have found it 10 years ago. So you're always asking yourself the question, okay, so what did we miss? And can we be creative? I mean, if this really happened, imagine yourself as the killer. You're going to touch certain things. You're going to do certain things. It's going to affect your relationship with other people. You're likely to talk about it with your closest friends. It might affect the way you have relationships going forward if you killed a woman in the past. These are places that we have to look to see if the behavior of this guy after the fact would be more consistent with somebody who did this than with somebody who didn't. And so we're doing the same thing here, where we're looking at Jesus and looking at the culture and saying, hey, if this is really who he said he was, I would expect there to be impact in nooks and crannies of culture that you might just overlook. And again, that's why I think, there's a chapter we do on the arts where if you look at the way that Jesus is depicted globally, forget about the West. It's not just that he has inspired the West and created a Western culture. I have an A to Z chart of all of the art that's been done about Jesus and nations from A to Z. And what's interesting about the person of Jesus in those reimaginings of the Messiah is that if you look at, for example, Buddha, and the way Buddha is depicted from one culture to the next, if you're depicting him in Asia, or you're depicting him in Africa, or you're depicting him in South America, you really can't tell where the depiction comes from, because he's pretty much described and depicted the same way. Yet if you look at Jesus as he's painted or sculpted or etched or drawn in China, as he's drawn in South Africa, as he's drawn in South America, he looks very different. And creatives have reimagined him with different types of media, different types of colors, different type of abstract representations. He's modified, because as the God of the universe, who's created all of us in his image, there's not one way to imagine God in your life. Jesus actually is an adaptable Messiah, in the sense that people in every culture have imagined him with their ethnicity, in their style of art, and he changes. And that's why he's inspired so many artists in so many diverse regions, is because there isn't one way you have to envision Jesus. And so you might say, well, gosh, this is like the white Jesus we see in the movies. Well, you know that that's just because that movie maker was probably white. But in every aspect of every corner of the world in which Jesus is worshipped, people groups see him in a different way, because God has inspired us. He is who he said he was, and God comes to us and reaches every single one of us, regardless of where we are, what we look like, and what medium we're using to paint him or to draw him. And because of that, he has inspired more artists globally to do more creative things and to advance the cause of art globally in a way that no other historical figure has ever inspired artists. And from the art painted and drawn and sculpted about Jesus, you can reconstruct every episode of the Gospels. And I do this, for example, I show you how you can reconstruct the Gospel of Mark just from the earliest paintings and drawings and sketches of Jesus that we find in history. So you'd have to destroy not just the manuscript evidence, but really the history of literature. He's the most written about character in all of literature, the history of art. He is the most inspiring figure in the history of art, the history of music the same way. Also, the 15 top universities in the world today were founded by Christ followers who have depictions of Jesus on their buildings. You have to destroy the campuses of the top 15 universities and the entire history of the fathers of the sciences in order to eradicate Jesus from the record book. And so that's the kind of impact I think you would expect. And when you see how much of the Jesus story can be reconstructed from these odd, disparate kind of aspects of culture, I think you'll be impressed and encouraged if you're a Christian, because this is the kind of impact you would expect God to have.
Exactly, exactly. Jay Warner Wallace, our guest today, America's foremost cold case detective with Person of Interest, Why Jesus Still Matters in a World that Rejects the Bible. It's from Zondervan Reflective Press and Zondervan Publishing House. So where can people go to learn more about your ministry and your writing, and where to get a copy of your newest book?
Well, you can always find us at coldcasechristianity.com. That's our ministry name. But also for this book, we've got a website called Person of Interest Book, personofinterestbook.com.
Warner, thank you again for making time to be with us on the bookshelf.
I appreciate you so much, David. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Our thanks again to Jay Warner Wallace, Person of Interest, Why Jesus Still Matters in a World that Rejects the Bible, from Zondervan Reflective Press. Once again, check out coldcaseministry.com, and you can also check out personofinterestbook.com. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Bookshelf. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and on your favorite podcast. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.